Okay. Welcome everyone. And I can see you're all catching up with each other. I'm sort of reluctant to step in, but I do have to. So, you're all very welcome. Lovely to see you all. And here we are again for another episode, Desert Island Retreats. I just really want to say thank you to Karmajit and Anna and team for what an amazing meal. Wow, that was absolutely delicious. Thank you very much. So we're here tonight to celebrate Suryamati. Woo! Gets an applause at the beginning. Fantastic. So it's my great honour to do this Desert Island Retreat, and I'm really looking forward to it. So let's start. Suryamati, you were born in 1951 in Sunderland, Wearside, into a Catholic family. Mm-hmm. Your mum looked after the family and your dad worked in the shipyards on Wearside. Yeah. This is just a very brief introduction. You've had a long and illustrious career, I would say, as a
very varied career.
A varied career. Managing various organisations, and most latterly, you were the chair of the Sheffield Buddhist Centre at a very important time. Actually, very significant time of great growth for the Sangha in Sheffield, and I think you were very instrumental in that growth, and kind of why we're in the position we're in now, actually. So yes, so it's very exciting to take you through your amazing music, and she's got amazing music. So yeah, let's kick off. Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood?
Okay, so, I was born in Sunderland, which is in northeast England, into a Catholic family. And we felt very much part of Sunderland, with its lovely beach, and its shipyards, and its Pyrex glass industry, and its football team. But as I grew up, I realised that there were an awful lot of Irish voices around me. A lot of the teachers in the school I went to, and most of the priests at the churches that I attended, had Irish accents. And the Catholic community in Sunderland was very much part of the Irish community. But we weren't Irish. I was third generation Irish on my father's side, and quite English on my mother's side, actually. My great-grandfather had come across in the potato famine 100 years before I was born. So we grew up in a council estate in Sunderland, and I was the first born of a family of what eventually were seven children. I had a very particular childhood. To begin with, actually, it was quite easy and peaceful. I remember a time when there were only two of us and then three of us. I remember that time, actually, as being actually very secure, very, very easy. And if I summon up that time, I'm listening on the radio to sing something simple, and I'm colouring in my colouring book, and my next sister down is also colouring in her colouring book, and the baby's in bed, and my mother, unbeknownst to me, was about to produce another sister. After the fourth one, I began to spot the signs, actually. But anyway, this was shortly before the fourth child, also a girl, was born. So there were four girls. And I don't think I realized at the time, I was nearly seven, but my life was going to change quite a lot. So what happened at around that time was that my dad was made redundant. He was a blacksmith in a shipyard on Sunderland. And the shipyards in Sunderland were struggling because the River Weir wasn't as big or as deep as some of the other rivers around the country. And his shipyard closed down. It wasn't getting the orders. So he tried to get other work and couldn't. And eventually he decided that he was going to have to leave Sunderland. And he went to Birmingham and got a job in a car factory, sent money home to my mother to keep us all. But my mum was struggling. I mean, she had Liz, who was the fourth baby. And at about the same time, my father's parents, her parents were already dead, but my father's parents, their health was declining and they weren't able to look after themselves. So with my dad in Birmingham, I was kind of expected to step up. And I went twice a week to my grandparents' house, did all their shopping, did some cleaning, did jobs for them. And then when I was at home, I quite often was looking after some of the children while my mother was attending to the baby and so on. So I very quickly became an organizer. I became quite bossy, probably, but I became capable of taking responsibility. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I think the things that the qualities that made me, the qualities that served me well when I became chair at Sheffield Buddhist Centre were being kindled in those early years. I was just taking a lot of responsibility. So, my dad was in Birmingham for about 4 years, actually, but he came back to Sunderland when my brother was born. My dad had been longing for a son after four girls, and he got a son. But he still couldn't get work in Sunderland. He was still working in Birmingham. And the critical point, the turning point came when my youngest brother, the first brother, Peter, began to talk. And when he began to talk, he really embarrassed my mother by calling the parish priest Daddy. He sort of, he was learning to talk. It was a man. Man was Daddy. We all thought it was hilarious, but my dad was really upset about it. And he came back to Sunderland, and he did eventually find work. It took him a little while, but he found work in Sunderland. Mm. So he was back at home. But it was starting to get to be quite a crowded house. Another boy was born. And then shortly before my 15th birthday, my younger sister was born. So then there were seven of us, nine people living in quite a small council house, actually, quite a crowded house. Mm. And what else to say? Yeah, I went to a Catholic primary school, and then past my 11 plus, went to a convent grammar school. And I did well academically. I coped with the work. I was top of the class a couple of times, but actually I was painfully shy and very, very lacking in self-confidence. And actually part of that was just being from a working class family that lived on a council estate. Mm-hmm. At a grammar school, nearly all the other kids were middle class. A lot of them were fee paying, actually. And the rest of them had passed their 11 plus. So it didn't serve me well in terms of confidence. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I did okay at school. And when I got to O levels and wanted to stay for A levels, along with everybody else in my class, my parents didn't even question it. They never said, you know, we could really do with the money. You really ought to go and get a job, for which I'm eternally grateful. It never even occurred to me at the time. It wasn't until later that I thought, well, you know, they could have said, we need the extra money. And they put me through A-levels and then let me go to college. And they did the same for every single one of my siblings. And I think they genuinely wanted the best for us. They just wanted us to be as good as we could be and to have the most chances in life that we could have. So I'm grateful to them. And actually, I'm also grateful for the Catholic education. I think that it answered something in me that that an ordinary education probably wouldn't have done. One of my very earliest memories was lying on my back in the local park, looking at the sky through leaves on a tree, and having an experience that was just dionic. It was an experience of everything is connected. It was an experience of wonder. I mean, now I would probably call it an experience of faith, really, of Shraddha. But it was definitely to do with connection and something beyond the material world. And my Catholic education kind of answered that, really. The nuns, for all they were strict and in some ways laughable, you know, all the girls used to laugh at them, but they really looked after us spiritually, and they every year they gave us a whole week's retreat where we had no lessons. All lessons were cancelled. We spent most of the week in silence. We heard Mass. We had devotional practice. We had talks from nuns and from priests. And we spent a lot of time sitting in the sunshine, kind of reflecting on what we'd heard. It was just really, it was really nourishing for me. And I was quite a devout Catholic. I love prayer. I love devotional practice. And I had a real sense when I prayed of the presence of God or the presence of something that was beyond me. So that was really important to me. But of course, you know, when I was, 16, 17 maybe, then I began to have doubts about the Christian God, certainly. I spent a lot of time arguing with friends about the existence of God and usually losing the argument. But I clung on with my fingernails to out of need, really, out of needing there to be a transcendental. That's a bit about my childhood and adolescence.
So it went very deep, your Catholic faith, didn't
it? It did. And actually, that meant it was quite difficult to give up when the time came.
Quite painful.
Pardon me?
Quite painful to give up.
It was very painful to give up. And actually, when eventually I did come to give it up, which was when I was at college, actually, was sort of going forward a bit, I felt that the music, the art, the devotional practice had all been working on my emotions, and I'd been duped. You know, I'd been manipulated. So I felt really, really let down by that, and had quite a strong reaction against it.
So this is quite a major theme, isn't it? And we're skipping ahead. We're skipping ahead a little bit in the story. Shall we come back to? Let's come back to your first track. Do you want to tell us about your first track? Because that links to your childhood.
It is. So, being a Catholic, when I was a teenager, I went to the local Catholic youth club, where there was a mix of 60s pop music, the Beatles, the Stones, Jerry and the Pacemakers, and Irish music, including lots of rebel Irish songs. And I remember even at the time thinking, but we're English, why are we singing these rebel songs of hate against the English? Anyway, that was the water I swam in. But one of the great things about the Catholic Club was that they ran Cayleys with live Cayley bands and callers, and they were just incredibly good fun. I really, really enjoyed them. So this first track connects me with those Cayleys from the Catholic Club. So the Cayleys gave me a taste for Catholic music that has lasted the rest of my life, really. Badania calls it the diddly diddly music, which it kind of is. When I left home, I began to explore recorded Irish music, and I listened to a lot of traditional stuff, the Dubliners and a whole lot of others. And this particular track is by a musician that I just got to really love, and I love most of his music. He's called Davy Spillane, and he's a piper. And this one is just called Davy's Reels, is one of my favourites.
Thank you.
did well at school, but you didn't go to university.
No. So I think because I was so shy, the teachers who were advising us about next steps suggested that I'd be much better off at training college and go into teaching. I think they probably thought, well, you know, she's the eldest of a big family. She'll be a natural as a teacher. But actually, it was really bad advice for me. I didn't have the confidence for, I don't know, the crowd control that you've got to do in schools. Anyway, I did, you know, what was expected of me. I applied for a place at a training college. The deal was that if you were going to training college, you could only go to a Catholic one if you wanted a reference from your school. I know. So I applied to the only Catholic training college that was run by lay people. It was a new college in Birmingham. And actually, I enjoyed my time there. But I enjoyed my time there. But I ended it being not a Catholic and not wanting to teach.
Irony.
It's interesting, actually. There were an awful lot of us that were giving up Catholicism as we moved through this college. And a lot of my friends were, they were ex-seminarians. They were young men who'd been trained in seminary, mostly in Ireland, but some in England, from being 12 or 13. And they'd jumped ship before taking their vows and moved over to a training college. And, you know, we all talked about religion. We all decided that it was the devotional practice that got you. Mm. And we all decided that, you know, we weren't having any more God. Mm. Yeah. Mm. So, I left college. I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do, really.
Mm. You had some time out and...
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
enjoyed yourself, by the sounds of it.
I did, yeah. Actually, yeah. Yes. So a lot of my friends anyway were getting jobs as teachers, and I really didn't want to do that. So I volunteered as a archaeologist on an archaeological site doing rescue archaeology. First of all in Milton Keynes when they were building Milton Keynes, and then in Cirencester. And the deal was in those days, I don't know whether it's still the same, that you in return for your labour. You were provided with accommodation and some living expenses. It's a bit like being on support at the centre, actually. I really enjoyed it. And actually, I discovered something about myself, which was that as soon as I was in a group of people, I was the one that they looked to organise things. So it wasn't long before I was the finds assistant on the dig, labelling the finds and putting them on a plan. And then when the whole team of us upped and left Milton Keynes and moved to Cirencester, I was the one who was dispatched to find us some accommodation. Mm. Cirencester was quite difficult for accommodation because it's a very middle-class area with very high rents, and we had very little money. So eventually I arranged for us to have a caravan parked on a piece of wasteland next to the Roman amphitheatre, or the remains of the Roman amphitheatre. It was absolutely amazing. I couldn't believe it when I climbed the slope and then looked down to realise that the amphitheatre was still there. It was all covered in grass, but a huge bowl. And in those days, it was just on a piece of waste ground. But Anya and I went back a couple of years ago, and it's now in the care of English Heritage and looked after much better. We lived in this caravan. It was a fairly vivid time. And actually, the next track is connected with that. So we were living in a caravan. It was 1972-3, and we didn't have any electronic gadgets in the caravan, So we had no way of playing music or anything. So what we did in the caravan at night was someone had a guitar and we all sang. And so this next track kind of connects me with that time, because one of the songs we sang was Suzanne by Leonard Cohen.
Suzanne takes you down to her place near the river. You can hear the boats go by, you can spend the night beside her, and you know that she's half crazy, but that's why you wanna be there. And she feeds you tea and oranges that come all the way from China, and just when you mean to tell her that you have no love to give her, then she gets you on her wavelength, and she lets the river answer that you've always been her lover. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know that she will trust you, for you've touched her perfect body with your mind. And Jesus was a sailor when he walked upon the water, and he spent a long time watching from his lonely wooden tower. And when he knew for certain only drowning men could see him, he said, all men will be sailors then until the sea shall free them. But he himself was broken long before the sky would open, forsaken, almost human, he sank beneath your wisdom like a stone. And you want to travel with him, and you want to travel blind, and you think maybe you'll trust him, for he's touched your perfect body with his mind. Suzanne takes your hand and she leads you to the river. She is wearing rags and feathers from Salvation Army counters, and the sun pours down like honey on Our Lady of the Harbor. And she shows you where to look among the garbage and the flowers. There are heroes in the seaweed, there are children in the morning, they are leaning out for love, and they will lean that way forever while Suzanne holds the mirror. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know you can trust her, for she's touched your perfect body with her mind.
Paddy. So, after the Roman amphitheatre, what happened next?
Okay, so what happened next is that I got my first proper job. And my first proper job started in sometime in 1973, I think. I became the primary school teacher for the Norfolk Museum Service, and I moved to Norwich. And that was the start of my very varied career, which you you referred to earlier. Interesting actually about my career. I was thinking that I restarted my career at least five times, which means that I sort of moved into five different worlds that kind of called up different qualities from me and helped me develop different kinds of skills. And actually, when I became chair here at Sheffield Buddhist Centre, I thought, that's why. That's why I had to do all of those things. I had to learn all of those skills to be chair of Sheffield Buddhist Centre. Anyway, this was the first of them. And, it was a lovely job. It was all the best bits of teaching without any of the crowd control or discipline or admin or anything like that. And I loved it. I particularly, I'd taken history at college, I'd done archaeology, so I loved using the collections for teaching. And I started doing the career exams that you take if you're a museum professional. And I thought that I'd probably do what everybody else did at Norwich, in the Norwich Museum Service, which is to, have a lifelong career in museums. But it didn't quite work out like that. So one of the things that I was doing in my spare time was volunteering at a night shelter for homeless men. And I fell in love with the manager. And the manager, who became my first husband, actually, was about to leave the Norwich night shelter to do teacher training in Liverpool. And I moved north with him, because that's what you do if you're in love. And I thought, oh, I'll get a job up there. But didn't, actually. Didn't get a job for a whole term, and then thought, I really want to go back to Sheffield, to Norwich. Mike did too. I spent most of the, because I didn't have a paid job, I did a voluntary job in special education. I got a job as a voluntary teacher in a hospital school for very severely disabled children. Thinking, I'll find out if I enjoy that sort of thing, and found that I didn't, actually. It was really tough work because it was so difficult to get a response from the children. Mike and I decided that we would move back to Norwich. We both got jobs in Norwich. I decided I would give teaching a try, which I did. I got a job in a local middle school, but the relationship didn't work out, and neither did teaching. I was confirmed in my suspicion that teaching really wasn't for me. So I then decided that I would retrain as a computer programmer. It was the beginning of the computer era, really. And the computer industry was really short of programmers. So there were lots of government schemes where you could get trained as a computer programmer for free. And I went on a six-month course, became a commercial computer programmer, and got a job working for Norwich Union. I really enjoyed computer programming. I thought, this is just like doing crosswords all day. It's fantastic. But I didn't do that for long, because what happened was that people spotted that I was good at organising and good at getting other people to do things. So, I don't know, maybe I worked for a year, but probably not quite that, as a programmer. But then I became a team leader, and then I became a project manager, and so on,
They spotted your talent.
That's right. They spotted the big sister in me, yeah.
Yeah.
Always been good at telling other people what to do.
So what about your, I think we're coming to your third track, aren't
yeah.
we?
Yeah, we are. So, yeah. So I work for Norwich Union for a bit, and then I worked for Midland Bank in Sheffield. That's what brought me to Sheffield in the first place. It's interesting, actually. Um, I During my early years working as a computer programmer and after I'd split up with Mike, I had this sort of intuition of the sort of person that I wanted to be. And that intuition included knowing a bit about art and poetry and music. Now, I knew nothing about classical music. So what I did was I joined the local library, the record library. And in those days, the deal was if you had a library ticket, you could get out 3 LPs at a time. So I went to the local record library and I got out 3 LPs at a time and I took them home and listened to them on my record player. And this next track, it was one of the first ones that really struck me anyway, that I really loved. So it's Ralph Vaughan Williams' "The Lark Ascending." I've seen it performed on several occasions, and I mean, every time it just goes straight to my heart. I think I love it so much because it connects me with landscapes. Landscapes and natural beauty have always just been really important to me, actually. And this one just reminds me of walking in the hills and larks rising out of the heather. And it kind of connects me with those early Dianic experiences when I was a child as well. It connects me with music and nature and something higher, really. Yeah. So The Lark Ascending.
So, you moved to Sheffield, but you were not sure about moving to Sheffield initially, were you?
I wasn't completely sure. So, this was the mid-80s, and my father had become quite disabled. And my mother, who was fairly fit, actually, was having quite a hard time looking after him. So I wanted to move closer to them. And so I applied for jobs in the north of England. I applied for jobs in York because of the North York Moors, and Leeds because of the Yorkshire Dales. And the recruitment agent wanted me to come for an interview in Sheffield. And I said, I'm not going to Sheffield. I've been through Sheffield on the train. I'm not living there. anyway, she said, yeah, but you're a walker, aren't you? Just go to the, trust me, go to the interview and leave yourself some time to drive out to the west of Sheffield after the interview. I was sold. I came to Sheffield for a job at Midland Bank at their computer centre, which is still there, actually. It's HSBC Bank now, isn't it? They've got a computer centre at Tankersley near the M1. I suppose, interesting that the important thing for me was being closer to my parents, but I didn't want to move back to the northeast, and landscapes. And landscapes have just always been really important. I just love to get up high and get the world in perspective and be in touch with a beautiful view and nature. Yeah.
And a counterbalance from working really hard as well.
Indeed. So, yes, but because I wasn't completely sure about Sheffield, and because I had a very cheap mortgage from Midland Bank, I decided to get a big house so that if I decided I wanted to move back to Norwich, I would be able to do that. House prices in Norwich and the whole of the south of England were much higher at that time than they were in Sheffield. So I wanted to be able to get back into the Norwich housing market if need be. So, interesting. I bought a very big detached house in Netheredge. And the people that I bought the house from, just completely by coincidence, were at a party that I was invited to while I was still house hunting. So I made an offer on their house. They accepted the offer, went to this party, they were there. And I got on with them really well. And the upshot of this was that they invited me to come and be their lodger until we exchanged contracts and they moved away from Sheffield and I moved into their house. And it was through them that I met Vidanya. Vidanya had previously been a lodger in their house. And Vidanya had obviously started something. Vidanya at that time was selling his house. He was about to move out of Sheffield and go to Guhaloka to help build Guhaloka. But he'd obviously sown some seeds because these two people, Anne and Bill, as they then were, later got in touch. Well, they later became Buddhists. They're now order members. And just by a very neat twist of fate, they're about to move back to Sheffield as Varasahaya and Shantipala. Anyway, that was how I came to Sheffield, and I was living in Netheredge. Nice big house, far too big for one person. I had a lodger. My siblings were able to come and stay with me. I had a family Christmas that I could invite my whole extended family to one Christmas. And because it was such a nice big house, when I decided I would stay in Sheffield, I was able to sell that house, and with the equity, I bought outright the house that I now live in. So I was able to live without a mortgage after that.
Smart move.
And yes, it was a very smart move. I thought so. So, I left Midland Bank. By that time, I'd kind of come across the Dharma. What order to say things in? Yeah, the very beginning of my Dharmic life was probably when Vedanya came back from Gukaloka. He probably wouldn't have come back, except that in 1987, he came back for a couple of weeks, early 87, probably. He came back for a couple of weeks, and we got together. We'd sort of known each other before that, but when he came back, we got together. And although he went back to Gukaloka then, it was probably because of that that he eventually came back to this country rather than staying out at Gukaloka as the only Spanish speaker. He probably would have been quite welcome on the Gukaloka team. But anyway, he came back to Sheffield, he really introduced me to the Dharma. He taught me to meditate, although I did do an introductory course at the then Leeds Buddhist Centre. There was absolutely nothing in Sheffield at the time. And I did an introductory weekend at Taraloka, when Taraloka was a farmhouse and a set of farm buildings that were being done up in the 80s. Mm. So
you weren't quite sure about Buddhism at first.
Well, I really like Buddhism. Well, I really like meditation. I like meditation. I liked ethics. I like Buddhists.
Yeah.
I hated puja. Oh, I think every retreat I went on in the first few years of my encounter with Buddhism, I left in tears after the puja. It wasn't just not liking it. It was, I would do the thing of just treat it like theatre, no harm just watching it. But I couldn't just watch it dispassionately. It wasn't just that I felt upset. I was furious. I just didn't want anybody else to do it either. I was just a raging mass of emotion. And then as soon as someone spoke to me afterwards, I just burst into tears. It was playing havoc with my emotional life.
So you liked all the rational bits, but you didn't want the emotional equivalence.
No, I didn't want the emotional equivalent of my rational understanding.
No.
I was very happy with the rational understanding, and that was enough. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, Vedanya had come back to the UK, mainly because of me, but then gone to work in Norwich because he wanted to work in the movement and there was nothing in Sheffield. He very cannily persuaded Naga Bodhi, Vedanya was working for Windhorse Publications, and Naga Bodhi, who was very influential in Windhorse Publications, was looking for a community house, really, where the team could live and work together. And they really couldn't afford anything in Norwich. But Vedanya persuaded them that in Sheffield they could get something really good. So Vedanya persuaded Naga Bodhi to bring the Windhorse team to Sheffield. They bought a house in Crooksmoor Road. And that house became, it became the community, which then became, the beginning of the fledgling Sheffield Buddhist Centre, and was the house that was sold in order to finance the buying of this premises several years later.
Mm.
So, yeah, bit of history.
Mm. Yeah.
Meanwhile.
Yeah.
Yes. Meanwhile, I'd given up my job at Midland Bank.
Yeah. And I think you'd flirted with becoming a mitra at that time, hadn't you? But you.
Yes, yeah. I did. So, in the early 90s, there was the beginning of a fledgling Sangha in Sheffield. There'd been meditation classes. Advaya Chitran Punyamala had moved to Sheffield. There was a little Sangha that used to meet at Crooksmoor Road. Can't remember which night, but I was very much part of that. And then Punyamala ran a study group for women. And I remember one by one, the other members of that study group would have a little chat with Punyamala, and then they'd become mitras. So I thought, well, you know, okay, well, I'll have a little chat about becoming a Mitra. And then I had a little chat about becoming a Mitra, and I went home and I thought, don't be ridiculous, Suryamati. Every time you go to a puja, you end up in tears. This really isn't for you. And so the next time I saw Punyamala, I told her I was leaving. And I did. I sort of went out on a huge orbit during the 1990s having hardly anything to do with what was then the FWBO. Mm. Every now and again, I would go to a meditation evening. I actually went to at least one meditation retreat at Taraloka during that time. Mm. I kept up a daily meditation practice, mainly because I just realized that I was a lot happier if I kept meditating. I'd have periods when I would think, you know what, I need some extra sleep. And for a while, I'm not a Buddhist, why would I meditate? And then after a little while, I would think, no, I need to meditate because I'm just not as happy if I don't. Mm. Mm. And I also, I had discovered solitary retreats and I loved solitary retreats. Mm. Mm. So most years during the 1990s, I had a solitary retreat somewhere. Fortnight usually, where I would meditate, do yoga, go for long walks, and just unwind. Actually, it was a bit of an escape valve because I was working very hard during that decade.
So I think you'd around the same time that you went on your big loop, you also got a very intense job, didn't you?
You were working
very hard.
Yeah. So I decided that I want, you know, I recognized enough about myself to know that I liked to work hard and do things really well. So I decided that I would do that in the voluntary sector rather than in the private sector. And I got a job working for an organization called Dial UK, which was the sort of headquarters for a network of disability advice centers that were run by disabled people. And it was in a bit of a mess when I got there. We had a mad director that had these incredibly grandiose plans for what we were going to do that were completely out of touch with the financial resources that the organisation had. We had a trainer that we discovered was defrauding the organisation. We had to get the police involved. We had a fundraiser who raised no money at all. And eventually, I ended up as the only employee. And had to start building it up from the ground upwards. But I decided it was an organization really worth saving. And I worked very hard. I worked very hard. I got rescue funding for it to begin with. I recruited volunteers, so I had a little team of volunteers, and we did a sort of basic job until I managed to recruit more people, get more funding, and then recruit more people. I felt it was a vocation. Actually, I felt that I was meant to be doing something for Dial UK. And I think that I did a really good job. Mm. When I left, we had 20 employees and quite a big turnover. Mm. We were making a big difference in this in the advice world, disabled people. Mm. And I learned a lot about the voluntary sector. That was really useful for when I came here.
So lots of experience. And during that decade, I think you were, one of your releases was to go to the City Hall.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, that was when Adanya and I started going to City Hall concerts. Mm. And I absolutely loved them. We had the Halle Orchestra and visiting orchestras, the Sheffield Philharmonic Choir. And there was this tradition all through the 1990s. They don't do it now, but... all through the 1990s, there was a tradition of every December, there was a performance of Handel's Messiah. And it was performed by the Sheffield Philharmonic Choir. and usually the Halle Orchestra. And I loved it. It was a wonderful tradition. And it's an incredibly joyful piece of music, really transporting. I love choral music anyway, and I've always loved Christian music. And I know that might seem really weird for someone who's rejected Christianity, but I thought of it as, this particular one, that I'm going to ask you to listen to the Hallelujah Chorus, which is like the crescendo, the biggest, loudest, most joyful piece of Handel's Messiah. And I kind of thought of it as being just, joy in reality, joy in, the wonderful things that people can achieve, the wonders of nature. It was, it wasn't just about Christianity, really. And I suppose more recently, I think, you listen to the Hallelujah Chorus and you think the Bodhicitta, the Dharmakaya, enlightenment, Dhyana. I mean, it's just a fantastic, joyful piece of music.
Great.
So, let's hear Hallelujah it. Chorus.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
In Sheffield, you know, and I used to think this happened everywhere. In Sheffield, when they play the Hallelujah Chorus, everyone stands. And I thought that must be a tradition everywhere, but I discovered it's not. It's just Sheffield audiences are particularly receptive.
Got a lot of heart. So during that whole time, you were working very hard. The whole of the 90s, I think, this was. Working very hard, meditating every day, pretty much.
Pretty much.
And going on at least a 2-week solitary every year.
I think I might have been integrating.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you've described it as a period of integration.
Yeah, I was. And during that time, Vidanya and I bought a cottage on the North York Moors. So I did a lot of my solitary retreats there. Later on, we sold that house and bought a different one in Silverdale. So in a way, the next two pieces of music, they connect me with those two landscapes. The first one, the North York Moors. The North York Moors are such a beautiful place. The North York Moors are a huge expanse of heather-covered moor, but the valleys are full of woods that have primroses and wood anemones and bluebells, all sorts of flowers. And the valleys are full of wild daffodils. It's an incredibly beautiful landscape. Shall I just introduce the next piece of music?
Yeah, let's talk about
that. The next piece is it's by someone called Judith Weir, who's a modern composer. And I connect it with the North York Moors because Vidanya and I saw her perform, wasn't this piece of music, but a similar one, just on the edge of the North York Moors a bit later. And I kind of connect it with that area. I chose this particular piece by Judith Weir because I love her music, but also because this is a setting of a poem that I also love by E.E. Cummings. You might have heard the poem. I'll just read the first verse. This is also very religious. I thank you, God, for most this amazing day, for the leaping greenly spirits of trees and a blue true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. And it kind of goes on in that vein. This one is to connect me with the North York Moors. Really beautiful place. Thank you.
So the job at Dahl UK was coming to an end, I think.
Yeah. Yes, only because, I began to think that I began to want more of a life than a life of just working, really.
Yeah.
I think that the meditation and the retreats had their effect. Mm. I think that I think that I wanted a bit more spiritual sustenance, really.
Mm.
And while Vidanya was away getting ordained at Gokuloka, or rather India and then Gokuloka, I got myself a different job.
Mm.
And the different job was working for Friends of the Peak District, what was then known as the Campaign for the Protection of Rural England for the Peak District in South Yorkshire. And, I went to work there because it was much nearer home, the pay was a lot better, and it looked like a really easy organisation to manage.
Mm.
And it was, they had plenty of money, they'd been left lots of money in people's wills, so it wasn't living from one funding crisis to the next.
Mm.
So, nice, easy job, I had a bit more headspace. It is also, by the way, an incredibly important organisation that you all ought to really know about, being inhabitants of Sheffield. It was actually set up in 1924, so more than 100 years ago, by a group of people who wanted to save the Peak District from encroaching development from the Sheffield and the Manchester side. The powerhouse of the organisation were a couple called Ethel and Gerald Haythornthwaite. And they were incredibly effective. There was no planning legislation in those days. So what they did to try and save the Peak District from development was they raised money to buy land. Mm. In 1931, they bought the Longshore Estate, which was up for sale. And the brochure, they have it in their archives as a historical document. The brochure showed the Longshore Estate covered in housing development. It was being sold for development. So they raised the money to buy it, and then they handed it over to the National Trust. And then they did a similar thing with Blackamoor, which is the bit that, you probably won't know where Blackamoor is, on the fringes of Sheffield. And they campaigned for greenbelt legislation and national park legislation. They were interrupted by the war, but during the war, they had a small band of volunteers who did a detailed mapping exercise so that by the time the war was over and national park legislation became a possibility, the Peak District had been mapped as a national park. Mm. And because of their efforts, when the National Parks Act was passed in 1949, the Peak District was designated Britain's very first national park.
Mm.
So you've got those people and that organisation to thank for the Peak District National Park that you probably all enjoy.
Mm.
And certainly it was the reason why I came to Sheffield.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, another landscape story. And actually, my next track is connected with a different landscape again. Because, in the early noughties, Vidanya and I sold a house in Rosedale and we bought a house in Silverdale. And Silverdale was the house where I did a whole lot of solitary retreats. We had loads of holidays and weekends there as well. But I did lots of solitary retreats there while I was training for ordination. We'll come back to that in a minute.
Mm.
But the next piece kind of connects me with that time. Should I talk about that?
So,
this next piece is it's a piece by Rachmaninoff. It's Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto. And I think of this music as The Music of Longing. I remember vividly being at City Hall and watching a pianist called Freddie Kempf playing it right in front of us. We used to go in the cheap seats right at the front, which was fantastic if there was a soloist because you could see their expressions. And I remember this piece of music. I remember just being bowled over by it. It's such a powerful piece of music. And for me, it connects with longing. And longing is what I connect with faith, really. Mm-hmm. I probably ought to also talk about a very pivotal retreat I did about this time. Shall I?
Should we hear the piece first?
So the reason I connect it with Silverdale is that I played this piece of music while on solitary retreat at Silverdale on several occasions. We had a little sound system there. And one of the things that I enjoyed on solitary retreat was listening to a bit of music. This is something that I played.
Thank you.
now is the time to tell us about your return to the Dharma.
Yes. Yeah. So, solitary retreats have been a regular feature of my life. And I, 2002, I went on a solitary retreat in a caravan in Nidderdale. The reading that I took with me was a book by Aldous Huxley called The Perennial Philosophy. And it's Aldous Huxley's attempt to compare all the world's major religions. And it had a huge impact on me. I think because he was an intellectual who was arguing for a religion as a way of connecting us with reality. And I think that I was ready to be convinced. And during that retreat, I began to connect with a lot of the devotional feelings that I had had in my life as a Catholic teenager, and began to see that they were not so different from the way that I felt when I was meditating well. Mm. And I began to allow a continuity between the emotional life I'd had as a Catholic and the emotional life that I really needed to have as a Buddhist, really. Mm. So it was a huge turnaround. Mm. I did the first newcomers course that was ever held in this building. Mm. I asked to be a Mitra. Almost immediately, I came back from the retreat. Mm. And before we'd had the Mitra ceremony later that year, it was December, I think, 2002, I'd already written my request for ordination and booked my first ordination training retreat. Mm. And then everything happened really quickly after that. I think all the hard work had been done over the previous decade, really. Yeah.
And it was also a time of a lot of change in Sheffield this centre being
the centre.
For Daniel was obviously very involved in the renovation project.
Yep, indeed. Amoga Vamsa was chair, Achara and Vidanya were incredibly active at the centre. Achara, of course, involved in the project of getting us the building and the renovation. Mm. When I was doing my newcomers course, we were coming in at weekends to paint the walls. Mm. This room was a building site for quite a long time, wasn't it? It was used, and then we had to get it re-roofed. So we went over the road to the place that was a school and is now flats, and had Sangha night over there for a while the roof came off and new roof went on. Mm. And Vidanya and Amoga Vamsa were doing a lot of the work around the centre itself, a lot of the teaching. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. So parallel in this building being transformed as a place of Catholic faith.
I know, yes. Yeah, interesting, isn't it?
Well. Just thought about that parallel then. Yeah. Mm. So you did your first ordination training retreat in 2003.
Yep.
And then it all went fairly quickly, really.
Yeah. Wasn't anyone to lead Mitra study for us to begin with, but then Punyamala led a group, I think from 2004, that I was in with the woman who is now Satyajyoti and one or two others. Yeah. Fantastic study group, which I really, really enjoyed. Yeah. In 2005, I realised that I was probably going to need a preceptor at some point. Yeah. And at that point, it was really funny. I don't know whether you noticed this, Punyamala. Every time I went out, I bumped into Punyamala. And I thought, I think the world might be telling me something. So I asked Punyamala to be my preceptor. Mm. And in 2006, she ordained both Mokshalila and I on Scotland. The only Scottish ordination retreat, I think.
Yeah. 20 years ago.
20 years ago this year,
Wow. Yeah. significant thing.
Yeah.
So, but after you got ordained, you started working for the Buddhist Centre quite quickly, didn't you?
Yeah. I had always assumed that my contribution to Sheffield Buddhist Centre would be to support Vidanya so that Vidanya could work here. And that's what I did. But in 2007, Amoga Vamsa retired, and they were looking for someone to join the centre team. And to begin with, I dismissed it because I thought, well, you know, I need to support Vidanya. And then I thought, well, actually, we don't have a mortgage and we don't need that much money to live. And maybe the centre would be able to afford to support us both. And I think, anyway, so I asked, and the finance people decided that they could indeed support both of us if I wasn't working. So I joined the centre team in the summer of 2007. Mm. And then at about the same time I joined the team. So the team then was Vajratara, Vidanya and me. You know, we were the three who were running the centre. About the same time, we began a process to look for the new chair. And anyway, there were other candidates for the chair, but there wasn't any money to support them. So everybody wanted, well, I wanted Punyamala to be chair at that time. Punyamala needed an income. She was still bringing up a family. So she couldn't do it. Anyway, in the end, it was decided that I would become chair. And I realised that I was a very new order member to be chair. So I asked for support from Punyamala, who I asked to be my spiritual support, and Achara, who I asked to be my organisational support. I became chair. So,
but all that business experience was...
Great. Yeah, it was. It was very
managing,
useful.
Managing volunteers and...
Yeah.
Managing finances and it all came together.
Working with trustees, voluntary sector legislation, all of that. Yeah, it was all really, really useful.
Great.
Including actually gardening, which we haven't mentioned. I came here and the centre needed a gardener.
Yes.
we had 2 acres of wilderness. Yeah. Well, not quite wilderness, but you know, it needed looking after.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I could take that on as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, we haven't mentioned your love of gardening, but I think that's coming right at the end. So let's talk about the next track, actually.
Yeah, okay.
So,
the next track is really about friendship because, landscapes are really a spiritual necessity to me. They ground me, they give me perspective. But for warmth, I need friendship. And so this bit, this piece of music, it just evokes the metta that connects me with other people. And so I wanted to have something that was about friendship. And I considered several things. I considered Nancy Griffiths, which connects me with my sisters. We used to play Nancy Griffiths music when we were together. I also considered Farewell to Stromness by Peter Maxwell Davis because that connects me with order gatherings and a particular occasion when Suchitta played this at an order gathering I was at. But this one is, the one I've chosen is from Elgar's Enigma Variations and it's called Nimrod. And this is the piece that Elgar wrote about a friend that he had been incredibly fond of, but who had died before he wrote this piece, actually. And Elgar said later of his friend, his place has been occupied but never filled. It was someone that he was really, really fond of. So this is Elgar, the Nimrod variation.
Thank you.
So you were chair for 8 years.
Yeah.
And it was a time of great expansion, wasn't it?
The centre grew a lot. When Moksha Leela and I came back from our ordination retreat, I think we brought the number of order members up to 13, something like that. And there were two chapters then. There was a women's chapter and a men's chapter. and very different from the situation now. And during that time, I don't know, I can't remember how many order members there were here when I stepped down from being chair, but an awful lot more. Yeah. I think there were probably three chapters of women and three of men. Mm. And the number of mitres had gone up, so that we were just about catching up with the London Buddhist Centre, which was the big Buddhist centre in the country, in terms of numbers of mitres and people training for ordination. So numerically, a huge time of growth. Mm-hmm. What else to say about it? A time of growth.
You made a lot of it happen with, initially Vajratara and Vidanya up front.
And yes, yeah. I did a lot of the organisation. Yeah. Yeah.
Making it all happen.
Yeah.
Oiling the wheels.
Mm. Yep. Leading volunteer events, actually.
Yes. Yeah.
The gardeners, Sangha works days.
Yeah.
The early summer fair and fundraising things.
Yeah. And that segues nicely into your gardening work.
Yes, indeed. So, and this last track, I wanted to have something about gardening. And actually, unless you go really twee, there isn't music about gardening. But this particular track, this reminds me of how I feel looking at a beautiful garden. Or looking at a beautiful bouquet of early summer flowers like the ones that we grow for the summer garden party in Seoul. It's just positive, upbeat, full of beauty and positivity. Mm. Sunshine, actually. Mm. Yeah, it's full of sunshine. Mm. So this is it's a track by Christina Pluha, who... runs a consort that play medieval and baroque music, early music, basically. And she herself has an amazing voice, a really beautiful voice, and this one is just instrumental, actually. But it's a chaconne. It's an Italian dance of the Middle Ages. And, yeah, as I say, it's just full of sunshine and colour. Thank you.
So you retired in 2016, but you've still been very busy in the last decade.
Yeah, still help with this and that. Yeah,
you're still heading up the gardening team.
Yep.
And sitting on the board of trustees, and still doing lots of work for the Buddhist Centre. So we're coming to the time when we need to leave you on your desert island.
Yeah.
How are you going to survive?
Well, I'm quite practical, so I'd probably be okay. I can do a bit of dry stone walling and gardening, of course.
And if you had to choose one of the tracks, which one would you save from the waves?
I know, it's hard. I think probably the lark ascending, in case there aren't any larks on the island. But also, actually, I was thinking about the lark ascending, that it's almost a musical sketch of Dhyana, so it might help with my meditation while I'm there.
And of course, we're not going to send you away empty. Well, you're not going to be totally alone on the island. You're going to have Bante, all his memoirs.
Yep.
You've chosen the Bodhicaryavatara.
Yes, for inspiration. Dhammapada is great for reflection, but what I'll need on the desert island is inspiration. So Bodhicaryavatara.
And which other book are you going to take with you?
Yeah, well, this is difficult. So I did think about gardening books. There are lots of gardening books that I could choose. But I think that probably, and I did think about The Perennial Philosophy, because I thought I could read it again. Yeah. but in the end, I think it's probably the Vimalakirti Nidesha. Because it's got everything, really. It's got perfection of wisdom. It's got myth. It's got all sorts of wonderful imagery. It's got humour. Yeah.
And I'll throw in Bante's reflection on the Vimalakirti as well.
Wonderful. Yes. Yes.
Great. And you can take a luxury. So what are you going to take with you?
Yes.
Your luxury.
Well, I thought about a bottle of dry sherry. But, you know, I'd get through it in no time and that would be the end. I thought about a bar of chocolate, the same problem. I also thought about a Victoria plum tree because I'm very partial to plums. In the end, I decided that what I wanted to take is a collection of annual flower seeds. There'd be larkspur and sweet peas and nigella and all the things, all the hardy annuals that flower early in the summer. And I'd collect their seeds and I'd keep them going so that I could have flowers.
Have them every year.
Yeah.
Until you were rescued.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Surimati. It's been a great delight. To hear your life story, but also listen to your beautiful music that you've chosen.
Yeah, so, thank you.
Yeah, great pleasure.
And thank you all for coming and listening.
Yeah. Thank you, everyone. Yes. Thank you. Huge thank you to the man on the sounds.
Thank you.
Without whom it would not be possible.
Yeah.
Also thank you to Moksha Devi for being my right hand woman tonight. Keeping
going. Yes. And thank you, Pranya Shree, for organizing the whole thing.
Maybe we should, I don't know, hear the lark ascending again. Is that possible? It's time to go. I don't know. Pick up work.